America Trends Podcast is part of the MHNR Network. MHNRnetwork.com.
What you're about to experience is one man's quest to see beyond the tumultuous period we're in and to envision what lies just beyond our grasp, yet well within our reach. Welcome to Larry Rifkin's America Trends, where the future has arrived, and it's just in time.
Welcome back to America Trends, Larry Rifkin along with John Krawczyk. And John, we're at it again. We did a podcast recently called Unprepared, and now we're looking at readiness again and how we might want to rethink readiness in a time when we've got cyber threats. And, you know, we just had that huge hack that went on throughout the government and some major corporations. We have super bugs, and we're in the midst of that pandemic still. And then we've got a climate crisis, so it's none too soon to begin rethinking our readiness.
Well, I think you're right. I think, you never know what's going to happen. I mean, in the past, we've had power outages for a week, so we know what it's like here where we live. And, you know, you look at what's going on in Texas, so we've got to, you know, prepare for the worst and hope for the best, I guess, is what I'm saying.
Absolutely. And I think sometimes in our sophisticated society, we think, John, that we can catch up to a disaster, that will never get ahead of us. But if anything, this pandemic, to me, John, has proven to us, let's not pretend. Let's make certain that we are in as preventative a mode and not a reactionary mode going forward. So we've got to think these things through. And there are new frontiers I learned by recording this podcast, John, in the whole area of what is called disaster research. And it expands on a lot of concepts about how well connected we really are as a society and what we need to do to make certain that we're all plugged in if and when something like this occurs again.
Well, you know, that, and I think we got to demand that Congress do their job and really protect our information on the internet. Because I'm worried someday we're going to wake up and our banks will be empty, and it's like, oh, what's going on? You know, I mean, it could happen with these hackers.
Actually, one of the sad things in America is with so much inequality, a lot of people wake up to that, and then they're not plugged in when a disaster does occur. They don't have the ways, the means, the resources to really kind of exclude themselves from certain things that are really affecting their own communities. So I just took what you said and I kind of expanded on it in a different way. But look, I think this podcast is really important because basically the 21st century, according to the experts, Sean, is fraught with all kinds of possibility as it relates to disasters. And that's why I am so glad that today we have got the director of the National Center for Disaster Preparedness at a fine institution in New York City to help us through all this. Are you ready to hear it?
I'm ready.
All right. Let's go to this episode of America Trends.
With us on America Trends is Jeff Slegomilch, and he is the director of the National Center for Disaster Preparedness at Columbia University's Earth Institute. Jeff, thanks for being with us today. Maybe we can start with where we are, and that is in the midst of a pandemic. How did we walk into this pandemic so unprepared?
It's one of those things, all the disasters mentioned in the concluding pandemics are these situations where we're contributing to the overarching threat, the bad thing that's trying to happen and our vulnerability to it. So with pandemics, including COVID-19, we're in this situation where we have greater an expansion of society, greater encroachment into biodiverse areas, closer proximity and sustained contact with animals. And then we're all connected with each other. You could get on a plane from Wuhan to the United States and be there within, you know, a dozen or so hours, you know, depending on how you're getting there. So we have this environment where we have, you know, more and more opportunities for things to get picked up and spread. And at the same time, we're not putting in the kinds of investments in early detection, in global health surveillance, in early intervention. We're seeing the challenges, stockpiles, and even stockpiles for all of a sudden when you need a lot of personal protective equipment for healthcare workers, when you need a lot of ventilators. And so it's sort of quite figuratively burning the candle at both ends here. And unfortunately, we're experiencing this very firsthand with COVID-19, but also in other environments, we're seeing increasing disasters as a result of climate change. And they all have this sort of similar theme of where, you know, we're contributing to both ends of the threat and vulnerability, but that we can also contribute to building resilience. We can reverse that trend.
I seem to be into the notion, number one, of a moonshot for everything. That, well, we can get ourselves into a certain amount of hot water and trouble, but we can quickly get our way out of this. And of course, Operation Warp Speed, getting us a vaccine relatively quickly, perhaps feeds into that notion, though it's after many hundreds of millions of Americans have died at the hands of this pandemic. And we also seem to think that we can isolate ourselves from the rest of the world, no matter how interconnected we are. We don't really think that anything over there can really impact us. Is that part of what's going on here, or am I wrong?
No, I think you're right, and I think that that's an important dynamic, is that the world is far more complex and getting more and more complex, and we look for very simple sound bites, very simple worldviews to try to force that complexity back into something that's easier to imagine, easier to understand. Of course, we romanticize the notion of a moonshot where we said we were going to do something and we did it. But that's really, you know, I think a dangerous way to go, because it gives the illusion that you know, we can just say we're going to do something, decide we're going to turn on a dime and do it. And as we see with pandemics, virus rages, and we have mixed messages on ways that people can protect themselves. And when all this is over, we'll have many hundreds of thousands. We already have many hundreds of thousands of people who have died from this in the United States alone. And that's just direct deaths. That's not counting other people who may have died from not going to the hospital because they were having an issue and were afraid to go in or not getting the treatment that they need. And also, as we look at disasters and catastrophes with longer time horizons, like climate change, there's no moonshot there. There's no 10-year plan to reverse the accumulation of hundreds of years of climate change, get us back to normal. It's a complete shifting in the way we operate with each other and in harmony with our environment. It's not going to happen overnight. It's a sustained goal. And so I think across all of our disasters, I mean, certainly the notion of investment, certainly the notion of commitment is important, but I think it becomes very dangerous to oversimplify things because it gives the illusion that there are simple answers. And to your other question on engaging in a global society, you know, there are two places we need to engage more. One is globally and the other is at the community level. You know, we have communities that are on the front line of this, that are experiencing this. Nobody lives their life in the halls of the UN or the Congressional Appropriations Committees. You live it in the community. At the same time, these problems are too big for any one group or any one select group of people to solve. It has to be done in collaboration with the global community. And so we need to be looking both in both of these directions to find the solutions to the kinds of disasters.
Politicians, do they get any kudos for stopping something that never really occurs? And are they therefore weary about putting too much money into things that may never happen, as opposed to trying to solve the problem on the other end? Is that part of the equation here?
It absolutely is. And there's actually been some studies within political science actually looking at how elected officials are incentivized. I mentioned one of them in my book where, you know, you look at elected officials are rewarded by voters, by people like you and I, assuming you vote and assuming I vote. But we're the ones who actually feed this incentive structure, where voters heavily reward elected officials for recovery, for response. If there's a lot of money that comes in afterwards, we reward them. If there's not a lot of money, we punish them. There's virtually no connection between preparedness, between prevention, even though we know prevention is much more effective. It saves more money, it saves more lives, it saves more livelihoods. So I think that that's also an important shift we're going to have to see, is that we can be angry at the politicians for being so reactionary, but we're the ones who actually reward them for being reactionary. And so we have to own our piece of it too, as the voters putting them in office.
When you think about this generation of young people, Jeff, and you sound like you're a younger person than I, clearly, the question really is, how do they respond to this? And how do people, families, communities recover? Because when I think about this younger generation of people starting out in their professional lives, they have already seen 9/11, and we can call that whatever disaster we want. They've seen a financial crisis in 2009 that might have stunted many who were just starting careers. And now the pandemic, cutting people off from their workplaces at a very critical time in their career development. This has got to have long-term impacts for a society. And I don't know that we can even tell what those are for a long stretch forward.
Absolutely. And actually, my colleague and the founder of the center I direct, Erwin Redlener, talks about this as the COVID generation, right? And how particularly younger children, how this is really going to map their future. And some folks who are fortunate to have ability and resources will do quite well, and others in who are being pushed deeper into poverty and further away may fall further behind. But I think looking all across sort of the spectrum of youth going forward, it's, you know, what tools do we need to get them to manage 21st century disasters? You know, as you mentioned, we're seeing these with increased frequency. That's not going to change anytime soon. Whether we're talking about climate change, aging infrastructure, polarizing politics, there's just a lot more variables. And so the tools we use, understanding things, the tools we use for managing it have to be more oriented towards this uncertainty and towards this complexity. So I think the best investment we can make is to actually prepare the next generation, whether they're just entering into their careers now, our early career, or in elementary school, you know, learning there is one plus one is two is thinking about what does an education need to look like to manage not the disasters we've had of the past century, but of the coming century, at managing these very dynamic, very complex relationships.
I know that many have said in the private sector, well, if you really want to be a good leader, you've got to focus on what are all of those potential downsides of business? What are the risks? Take that assessment and take it very seriously. Do you think that the private or the public sector does a better job of this, or do you think that they both find it difficult to focus in advance and not really scurry after something has happened to make adjustments?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. You know, in some ways, you know, you'll find a lot of reports, the forward-looking things, you know, if we're looking about our vulnerability, see all kinds of reports and studies and things commissioned by public agencies and planning efforts, some of which are paying off now, believe it or not, in the public sector. And yet, those are always sort of brought up in commissions to say what went wrong, and you should have known because we already had these reports and this data available. So collecting information, we see a lot on the public sector. The private sector is an interesting one too, because I think when we talk about dealing with complex information and dealing with uncertainty, some of the best tools and methods exist in the private sector. They have to deal with, you know, should we invest in this new factory? Should we invest in these financial instruments? And so it's mired in uncomplexity. And yet, outside of a few exceptions, and there are some interesting groups in the private sector emerging, really trying to be forward-looking, it's kind of like with politicians, their incentive structure comes back to investors who want to see a certain return on investment. And at the end of the day, it's about meeting that. It's about meeting quarterly earnings reports. And so one of the things I talk about in the book is the need to rewire these different incentive structures. I think the tools are there. I think the information is starting to accumulate. How do we translate that into action to actually get folks in the public and the private sector to more uniformly and more cohesively actually implement those and translate those into the way that they assign value and make decisions?
In the book, you tell us that disaster research is a whole new area of exploration. I know that after 9/11, of course, there were so many courses that were built around security and cybersecurity and the like going forward. I mean, do you think that this moment in time is going to spawn a lot more activity, academically and otherwise, in disaster research? And what does that field look like?
The field of disaster research, I mean, obviously disasters have been written about, whether by the poets or, you know, that term disasters of biblical proportion. You know, they've been written about for long periods of time, but studied very analytically, we're really looking at roughly a century's worth of scholarship on it, and a lot of that really being over the last maybe two generations. Post 9/11, it was a huge influx of resources, attention, interest, which led to, as you mentioned, the creation of a lot of these programs. And so they drew from a lot of the methods of these researchers, but we're still trying to settle in terms of, you know, finding stable funding streams, developing strong research methodologies, and fitting in within academia, an academia that creates, you know, sort of deep boundary expanding science and mathematics and medicine and physics. Disaster sustainable development are at the intersection of a lot of these things. So even academia is wrestling with how do you look at disasters, which is really a connection point between a lot of different fields of science. But I should say that you're seeing a higher level of scholarship. You're seeing more continuation. You're starting to see more robust degree programs, not just more degree programs, and more of a career path. I think with COVID-19, it's obviously a very, with apologies for using a very academic term, it's a very data-rich environment across the world where you're seeing and able to measure the consequences of different kinds of actions, of different kinds of behaviors. And this should be, if properly leveraged, really, really useful in terms of understanding what aspects of society, you know, we're seeing communities of color, communities of lower socioeconomic status with a higher burden of being out of work, of fatalities from COVID-19, of all the various disruptions. We need to learn as much as we can about this so that we can start to translate that into better policy, better solutions to prevent disasters, to bridge some of these inequities in our society, and ultimately to make sure that the next time this or something like it happens, there are less deaths, less jobs lost, less livelihoods lost.
We're rethinking readiness today on America Trends. And Jeff, I've got to ask you, though, you say in the book that the hard truth is that while disasters may shake and shock the world of those who are affected, they rarely impact broader society for more than a short period of time. And I know that we are that kind of world where you see one disaster after another. You see a hurricane that really affects people in Baton Rouge, and you say, oh, that's terrible, and let me give $20 to move on with my life. Or we see the impact of Hurricane Maria on Puerto Rico, or just a whole range of things, and we're going to continue to see much of that through the climate evolution. But the question is, do you think this pandemic, because it is worldwide, because of the way media travels today, that this will have a more far-reaching, long-term impact than many of the other disasters, which, as you say, again, are more localized in terms of their long-term effects?
Yeah, it's certainly one for the history books. Whether it's a chapter in that history book or a footnote, I think remains to be seen. And a lot of what remains to be seen is to what extent does it change the way we behave? Does it change the way we do things? There are certainly, we're seeing on the plus side, a lot of incredible progress on the biomedical side in terms of coming up with treatments and vaccines coming from collaborations across groups that are normally competitors. At the same time, we're seeing a lot of breakdown in leadership, fault lines along political lines that are making it very difficult to trust science, to trust the information coming out. And that's just in the United States. So what this means in terms of the legacy of COVID-19 remains to be seen. But it's definitely absolutely one that has the potential to alter the trajectory of how we do things, hopefully for the better. But a lot of this is going to depend ultimately, as we eventually work our way to the other side of this pandemic, how we choose to alter our relationships with each other, with nature, with our development as a result of this. Is this an inflection point, or is this, you know, a hurdle along the way without significantly changing the way we think about readiness in our society?
The subtitle to your book is A Brief Guide to 21st Century Mega Disasters. You tell us in history there have been different classes of disasters. There are mega disasters that are of such a large scale that they disrupt the very systems and processes designed to manage them. So help us to understand what is a real mega disaster, I mean, as you typify it.
It's a term that's used a lot, and it's one of these terms I like to say that is a squishy term with fuzzy edges. So it's not they're not as neatly laid out on the table as one might hope, but essentially mega disasters are that. So I think in certain scales, you know, you look at Hurricane Katrina and you look at how it really rendered a lot of emergency management systems ineffective by just such widespread disruption. And so we've seen a couple of those in modern times, at least within the scale that we're looking at them. But then if you zoom out even further, you look at these history-altering mega disasters, the Black Death in Europe, the Great Potato Famine in Ireland, that completely alters the theological structure of the world that we work within, where you have changes that you know, the world doesn't look the same again. Some of these, with the plague, you can still see genetic markers to this day of ancestors, folks who survived. And I think it's a reminder that the longer you sort of string out the timeline, the longer you look at things, you start to see these patterns. Actually, pandemics, about once in a generation, we see a major pandemic. We've been waiting for the next big pandemic, like we saw in 1918. We figured we were due for a pandemic. We thought it would be influenza. We were keeping a close eye on a lot of influenzas, although I should say coronaviruses were on the map, especially since the emergence of SARS in around 2003. But history has patterns when you look at the centuries and the millennia that we should be so bold as to think we're exempted from. Because with every new technological advance, as I mentioned in the book, whether it's our infrastructure, whether it's cybersecurity, whether it's our interconnectedness, we may be closing off one vulnerability with our advances, but we're creating another one. And with the rapid spread of COVID being one of the most recent examples of where we have incredible medical science to prevent the spread of disease, but we've also given disease the channels to spread much, much faster.
Explain to us, you say in the world of disaster management, there are two aspects to danger, the threat and the vulnerability. So what do we pay more attention to? And do we seemingly always prepare for the last war? In other words, how do we imagine we are going to go forward, because the pandemic is not the only thing, and I want to get into the scenarios that you present to us in the book. This may not be the next big thing.
And I think to explain a little further, you're absolutely right. We do tend to look at the historical disasters to carry lessons forward, and even for the most part, how we rate risk, whether it's for insurance, whether it's for flooding risk, for planning, it's usually based on the last 10 years, the last 100 years. We look at history for that guide. And with climate change sort of changing, our interaction with weather patterns changing, looking back historically is not a good guide for what we're looking at going forward. I know I had mentioned historically you see these patterns, and it could be good for finding clues. We're seeing wildfires. We're seeing hurricanes later in the season. We're seeing things that are more and more unpredictable. This means the frequency of disasters we've seen over the last 10 years is probably going to increase over the next 10 years, but it gives us clues into the kinds of things that we'll see. But ultimately, when we look at disasters, right, there's the threat of a storm, the threat of an earthquake. And then, you know, a colleague of mine gave the example, you know, if you're in an open field during a 9.0 earthquake, you're in a pretty safe space. That's not really a recipe for a disaster. Now you take a large earthquake and you go to Haiti with a lot of dense construction, with concrete, without a lot of the rebar and reinforcements, and it's actually a very devastating environment. That's a vulnerability, and that's a constructed vulnerability, one that we've built and we've created. So we've actually contributed to the disaster. A lot of the way we define emergency management in policy and in legislation that authorizes a lot of our emergency management structures is focused very heavily on consequence management. What do you do after the bad happens? The problem is the table is set for disasters through economic policy, through social policy, through all of these other things that either drive us towards vulnerability or can pull us towards resilience. So again, sort of getting on with the theme, these are some of the structures where we need to stop thinking about, you know, how do we put the fire out, but how do we actually stop the fire from starting in the first place?
I'm so glad that you referenced that, Jeff, because I've got to ask you about this. Here we are in the United States, and we have more information available to us, perhaps, than anywhere else in the world. Of course, we have a lot of misinformation available to us as well. But think about this. When we look at the habitability of America going forward because of climate change, why is it then that many people are moving to the areas where one might say that if you look down the road 20 to 30 years, You won't be able to get a mortgage. Nobody will insure you because you're living in the hottest, the most shore-involved areas. And these are the most desirable, and the message still hasn't gotten out that those aren't the best places to be going forward.
Well, I would say that part of the reason people are moving there is because they can, because it's affordable, because they're still able to get the long-term mortgages on properties that may not be viable, and they're able to get insurance on them. And so this is where it comes back to the incentives, that even as individuals, you know, we're not sitting there, you know, and even I, you know, with my close proximity to so much of this information, would be lying if I told you that I consider all of this in every big decision I make in my life. There's a convenience factor to being able to buy a place, and you would assume that if it wasn't safe, they wouldn't have built it there. So I think that there's another interesting piece, and it relates back to COVID as well, too. There have been a couple of roundups, one in particular in Nature, on what behavioral science teaches us about pandemics and how people respond. And I think another really important piece is that, you know, having knowledge is one thing, how you use it is another. And one of the things that the researchers talk about is they talk about how in collective societies with a collective community identity, will tend to be willing to make sacrifices for the greater good much more easily than more individualistic societies. Individualistic societies will be less willing to make sacrifices for the greater good. And I think this shows you why you can have messages on social distancing in more environments like in parts of Asia, as we've seen in China and Korea and elsewhere, and they stick a lot better than in more individualistic societies in parts of Europe and the U.S. and elsewhere, where people are more preoccupied with individual freedom. I'm not trying to say in the grand scheme of things that one is better than the other, but when you're talking about response to a pandemic, the tools you use for response in a collective identity environment are not the same ones that are going to be effective in an individualistic society. But bringing this knowledge together and applying it in this context, that's the ultimate next step. It's not enough to just have the books on the shelf.
Do you think there's also a difference? The societies that you're talking about in Asia, I understand about the more collective responsibility that they seem to take, no matter what kind of government they're under, but they also seem to use a lot more data and a lot more information, and they trust it more than we seem to here in America.
I want to be a little careful with this because that in this context of COVID-19, you're seeing it very effective. When you look at things like the use of eminent domain for development, people leaving their homes, freedom of the press, a lot of things we hold valuable are obviously less effective in other
right.
circumstances. So it's very much a moving target. But I think that you do see more use of data when governments and when leaders and when community leaders sort of model that and sort of come together around that. So data has been used as a weapon. Science has really been weaponized. And I'll say you'll see this with climate change, with the pandemic, where folks are trying to say that's not real and they're getting a large audience. At the same time, I would say this is not solely a right and left issue. You do see some conservative pundits trying to deny the science, and you do see some progressives that are actually exploiting the science and saying that it says more than it actually says. And so all of these things undermine trust. And when it undermines trust in the science, it becomes a tool of punditry rather than a tool for the betterment of society. One other important thing I'll mention is that, you know, the science will only take you so far. The science can only sort of give you numbers and give you data and mm-hmm. frame your uncertainty. At the end of the day, you have to make a value choice, and that belongs with the leadership within society. So I can't tell you how many times we've worked with partners at the university say, well, can you model this and tell me what the right answer is? Like, or can you research this and tell me what we should do? And I said, well, I can research this, but I can't tell you what to do. I can just frame out the decisions. You know, I think back to this whole public health thing of these, you know, really large 64-ounce sodas. We know that by denying that to people, the ability to buy a 64-ounce soda, it'll lead to, you know, for myself personally, like if you deny me a smaller soda, I'm gonna drink less soda, and it's going to be better for my health. But what I can't reconcile is, isn't it my God-given right to drink as much and choose whatever size I? So there's a value system there that science isn't going to give you the answer to. So I think that's the other piece is we do need to use data more. And at a certain point, we need to acknowledge that science isn't going to give us the answer, that it's up to our identity as a society and our leaders to then assign value to the inputs that the science is able to give.
That's a very interesting observation. You give us five scenarios where human development contributes to both the threats we face and our vulnerabilities to them. And I don't know that you do it in any particular order, and we're not going to be able to go into it deeply, and I want people to get this book. It's a very short tome, but very important, Rethinking Readiness, and we'll talk about it at the end of the podcast. But you tell us there are bio threats, and of course, COVID being one, climate change, which you have alluded to throughout the course of the conversation, aging and vulnerable critical infrastructure, cyber threats. We've just seen that our own government from, we think, Russian actors, and nuclear conflict. You know, it's interesting, the last one, nuclear conflict, because I did a podcast recently, and I don't know if I'm the only one who thinks this, Jeff, but I think that has almost gone off everyone's radar. I don't know if they thought Cold War was over, that these repositories of nuclear weapons, we know we needed to secure them in the old Soviet Union, but now they are rampant throughout the world. I don't think we tend to give it much thought, but nuclear conflict could, well, destroy us overnight, literally.
I honestly was not intending to put it in the book to begin with. my colleague, uh-oh, Dr. Redliner, he had shared with me these five notions of what we would be facing in the 21st century and graciously allowed me to kind of run with it and write the book around it. And he's the one who convinced me the importance of the nuclear side. And the more that I looked into it and the more that I understood this more and more, the more I realized it was essential and had to be a part of it for exactly the reasons you just mentioned. It's that we have these threats, these vulnerabilities from the past. And you know, the Cold War, where we have these global killing arsenals of the Soviet Union and the United States, was a very dangerous time. But there were also some factors that made much more stabilizing once we got to mutually assured destruction and everyone has kind of lined up with each other. But some would argue that today we actually have more likelihood for the use of nuclear weapons than ever before, but just on a smaller scale. And because of that higher likelihood and smaller scale, the way we prepare a nuclear conflict is actually very, very different. And as folks can read in the book, in many ways, nuclear conflict, the use of a nuclear weapon is much more survivable now in the kinds of scenarios we might see it used than in the global killing onslaughts we would have expected, you know, in the simulations in the movie War Games, right, when they were playing global thermonuclear war. It's a very different threat, and it's important we understand it and we engage people around it, because there are actions that can be taken that can save a lot of lives if we rethink sort of this threat in a modern context.
Well, the bio threats, of course, are most present on our mind at this moment. But the nuclear conflict, as you admitted, for many, has fallen off the radar. What of the other vulnerabilities and scenarios that you present we like to draw to our attention today before somebody goes out and gets a book and really delves into the way you have described each?
I think critical infrastructure is one that starts to allude to, and then towards the end of the book, these cross-cutting issues, because this is something where, again, you know, having better transportation, you know, our, as we're seeing that now with some of these vaccines at these ultra cold temperatures, cold chain storage, you know, it's created these incredible opportunities and possibilities, improved standard of living, but it's also created these vulnerabilities. And we've had some near misses and some very significant failures of infrastructure, like in Flint, Michigan, like the Oroville Dam in California that nearly collapsed, that actually have the potential to render places with large populations virtual and livable, to create large amounts of a term we only think about in humanitarian missions abroad, internally displaced persons. We had a hint of this in Hurricane Katrina, but it's a growing threat, and I think it also starts to illuminate this incentive structure, the complexity of the problems. We like to build things and cut ribbons, but then how do we actually upgrade that and sustain that? And again, a lot of these things that actually create a tremendous amount of benefit for a lot of people, if they're not properly tended to, if they're not properly understood, and we do the boring work of maintenance and the hard work of getting consensus, can actually create an is creating very significant vulnerabilities to the things that we take for granted.
You tell us at the end of the book that more investment is necessary and we have to meaningfully engage communities. I think people hear that and they're trying to understand, what does that mean and what can I do in my own way?
So I think, you know, for right now, as folks are looking at this, you know, looking to your community, looking to be involved, looking to be, you know, as I mentioned before, a lot of these issues we like to blame Congress for being too reactionary. You have a vote. We vote these people in office. And even if there's not an election coming up, you're one of their constituents. To be honest, your elected official is more likely to read an op-ed in the local circular than they are in the Washington Post or New York Times, because that's where their votes are coming from. Same thing with these organizations, you know, threatening to divest in fossil fuels is really pushing the industry to make changes that lots of protests and picket signs have not done. You start to engage with that. But then also, you know, there's a lot of research, you know, getting to know your neighbors, you know, people who know their neighbors. Communities that are more connected socially tend to do better in the face of disasters. They tend to have better health outcomes, better mental health outcomes, and those are better connected with their legislators, with their mayors, with their whatever governance structure is in place to receive recovery funds faster. So these are all things that can be done at the household level, at whatever level you're operating in. And then the other is really, you know, we talk about meaningfully engaged communities. That's a little bit too of where we have, you know, a lot of very powerful actors on the national and international stage that like to present things to communities for their approval. And I think if it doesn't feel right, if there's a group coming in and telling you something that isn't meeting your needs or the needs of the community, to speak up, to share with them and make sure that they understand what works and what doesn't work. So all of this ultimately coming in different ways to be involved. I don't think there's any really wrong way to be involved, because you're being respectful and peaceful with others. But involvement is a good thing. Apathy keeps us on the current trajectory.
Jeff Schlegelmilch has been with us, and a really fascinating book. And by the way, Erwin Redlener, I must say that I know he's been an inspiration to you, and I've seen him on television so many times during the pandemic, and always loved his perspective on things, and I think a great guide in helping you formulate the ideas behind this book, Rethinking Readiness, A Brief Guide to 21st Century Mega Disasters. I thank you so much for being with us today on America Trends.
Thank you so much for having me. I've really enjoyed the conversation and really appreciate you doing this and just giving the room to talk about these things and giving them enough time to air out some of the ideas.
Okay, Jeff, thank you so much.